The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening, everyone. Hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 26th of October, after which I'll hand it off to Eric Getzoff for Hour 2. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got some great guests on the lineup card for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in one of the greatest hitters of all time, who's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame, by the way. And that's Al Oliver. He'll be discussing his book, Life's a Hit, Don't Strike Out. Next up, we'll talk to author Hal Bodley about his acclaimed book, How Baseball Explains America. Perfect topic for this Fall Classic weekend that is upon us. Two great baseball guests to warm us up tonight before the Giants-Royals matchup out in San Francisco. You guys can get Boardwalk Empire and Walking Dead on demand tomorrow night when there's nothing on. But tonight you got Sports Talk 1240. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, Sports Talk 1240, where you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by and give us a look, and more importantly, give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest played 18 years in the major leagues with the Pirates, Rangers, Expos, the Giants, Phillies, Dodgers, and the Blue Jays. Seven-time All-Star, won the NL batting title in 1982, and he was a world champion with the Pirates in 1971. Batted .303, 2,743 hits, 219 home runs, and 1,326 RBIs. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Al Oliver. Al, welcome aboard.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice being aboard.
It's great having you. Now, Al, who did you root for growing up? Any influences, favorite players?
Well, being from Southern Ohio, you know, we were big Cincinnati Reds fans here.
Okay.
And so I was a Reds fan growing up, and the guys that I watched, well, really was the whole team, but the one player that stood out was Vada Pinson.
Right.
And I think the reason why, because he was left-handed, and, of course, you know, me being left-handed, and, of course, Frank Robinson was on that team, but they had a lot of great players, like Ted Kozuski and Johnny Temple and Roy McMillan and Gus Bell and Wally Post, Ed Bailey. You know, I still recall those guys, Bob Perkey.
Right.
You know, it was a great team to follow. So I grew up being a Cincinnati Reds fan, and I was a Reds fan all the way up until I was called up to the big leagues, and I finally had to face the Reds.
Yeah, right. And that was some ball club to face back then, too.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. I'm always kidding Don Gullett, who lives about 5 or 6 miles from me. He has at least three of my World Series rings.
Yeah. Now, Pinson was a guy who deserved consideration for the Hall, too.
I thought so.
Yeah.
You know, it was ironic because what I didn't know when I left the game in 1985, he was the only guy that had more hits than I had that was not in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And he was a great all-around player. He could hit it all. I always thought that he belonged.
Yeah. Yeah, and I believe his son, Vada Pinson, he's got a Facebook page, too, looking to get his dad in the Hall.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Now, as I said, he's very deserving as well. Now, we're talking to Al Oliver tonight. The 69-70 Pirates, some great ball players on that ball club as well. Now, let's talk about some of those guys. Two Hall of Famers right at the top. Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell. Talk to me a little bit about Clemente, the great Roberto Clemente.
Well, the first thing I can say about Roberto was he was for real. You know, there are a lot of people in the world that put on a real what happened to him early in his career. But he was for real as a person. And that's the thing that stood out with me with Roberto. He was consistent day in and day out. And as a player, unfortunately for the ones who did not see him play, he was a sight to see. He was a great right fielder. I don't know how to rank him as far as right fielders, but he was definitely the best right fielder that I ever saw. It wasn't anything that he couldn't do as a player. So he was an all-around player, person, and the best player, person that I ever played with.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how about Willie Pop Stargell?
Well, of course, Roberto was a leader, and so was Willie Stargell. But they led in different ways. Roberto led more by example. Now, Starge was more on hands with the players.
Okay.
The one thing that I'm going to laugh every time I talk about Will is because he was a prankster. And he would always have a team party whenever we would lose three or four games in a row, which for us was good because at his parties he would always have this purple passion, which was grape juice and grain alcohol. And guys would start drinking, and all of a sudden start stumbling around and carrying on. And I was a non-drinker, but that was his way of trying to get the guys loose. And luckily, we always had an off day to follow.
Yeah.
So Will was smart in that vein. But Will was a guy that kept things in order. I mean, he never was too high or never too low. I saw him at times. He could have blown up, you know, with maybe some of the questions that was asked or maybe some of the times that he struck out or he might have made an error. But he was always calm, and that was a calming force to our ball club. And that's the thing that really made him the Hall of Famer that he was. He was consistent as a person, and he was an excellent people person. He knew how to motivate each player individually.
A good quality, definitely. And he could hit the ball a mile, too.
Oh, Lord. I still remember the ball that he hit out in Los Angeles. You know, of course, our dugout was on the first base side, and he hit the ball, and all the players got up off the seat because we knew it was going to go a long distance. But never did we ever think that we would never see the ball again.
Yeah.
Well, what happened was the ball left Dodger Stadium, and it was amazing. I mean, I've only seen one of the guys hit a ball into the night, and that was Dick Allen, my year off Bob Beale, in Connie Mack Stadium in Philadelphia. But Will could launch some balls, and
yeah.
Not only was he a long ball hitter, a home run hitter, Will was a good hitter as well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now, how about at second base, Mazeroski? Good glove?
Well, if he got you the ball, you're out.
Yeah.
I don't ever call Maz missing the ball. You know, I travel a lot, and I do a lot of public speaking, and I always tell people that I'm really responsible for all three of those guys being in the Hall of Fame. Because when I first came up, I was a first baseman, in which I was known to be an excellent fielding first baseman, but any ball that was hit to my right, I let Maz have it. So I made him work.
Okay.
And then when I had to make the transition from first base to center field, any ball that was hit to right center field, I let Roberto have it. Then any ball that was hit to left center field, I let Stargell have it. So I made those guys work awful hard to be Hall of Famer.
Yeah. All right, now.
Maz was a great player. And, you know, as some people may know, especially guys who were around then, there was no need to try to break up a double play because his legs were like tree trunks. You know, it's like hitting a trunk of a tree. You wouldn't move.
Right.
And Maz didn't move neither. But he was an excellent second baseman, and he was also a clutch hitter, too, a good RBI guy.
Yeah. Well, between him and Gene Alley were a great combination.
Oh, it was a great combination. You know, when I first came up, you know, I had the pleasure of being a first baseman and to be on that receiving end, and those guys could turn some double plays.
Yeah.
I mean, they were outstanding fielders. You know, I can't say enough of those guys. When the ball was hit on the ground, you might as well just chalk it up. it's going to be a double play ball.
Yep. Now in those days, Al, it's a little different than today. Most of the teams in the National League and pretty much around baseball, most of the teams had a prolific catcher. You had Johnny Bench. You had Ted Simmons. You had Jerry Grody on the Mets. The Pirates had Manny Sanguian. Talk a little bit about Sanguian. He could pretty much do it all.
Manny could do it all, you know, because Manny was a great hitter. He had great speed, a strong arm.
Mm-hmm.
He was just an outstanding receiver. He was all around. And in those days, as you had mentioned, there were so many really outstanding catchers.
Right.
Randy Hunley.
Another one, right.
With the Cubs. All those guys were great catchers. And, you know, when you have good and great catchers, you normally have a pretty good and great pitching staff as well, as mm-hmm. it was when I first came up. And when I look at the times when I first came up, I'm looking at potential Hall of Fame pitchers or all-star pitchers almost day in and day out. And you almost had to be able to hit when I first came up. And that was the difference back then than as opposed to now. Even the all-around players, there were at least two or three future Hall of Fame players on each team.
On each staff.
When I first came up.
Right, you're right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you're looking at the Mets. You had Seaver and Kuzman. You're looking at the Cardinals. You had Gibson and Carlton. Right? You're looking at the Cubs. You had Jenkins, Bill Hands, guys like that. Each team had at least a one and two that you were going to face that gave you a fit.
San Francisco.
Yeah.
You had
Marichal and Gaylord Perry. Yeah.
Right. I mean, everywhere you went, it was just amazing. You had better be able to hit or else you were in trouble.
Yeah. You were riding the pine. Exactly.
Thank you. You're right.
Now, how about a pitcher on your club, Doc Ellis? I was just reading a little bit about Doc today, and we've heard some things. You ever see any antics out of Doc?
Well, if you played with him, you did.
Okay.
But you know what? I'll say this. You know, Doc was the best friend that I had in baseball.
Okay.
And people always wonder, how can this guy, the personalities just didn't mix.
Okay.
You know, I was more of a private guy, kind of laid back. And Doc was more outgoing and flamboyant. But I think that's the reason why we got along, because we had respect for each other as a person. You know, Doc had a quality that sometimes I wish I would have had, have been more outspoken. You know, some people thought I was outspoken, but I was not.
Mm-hmm.
I was candid when asked a question. But then again, Doc, on the other hand, the part that he liked about me was my discipline. He always said that he wished he had my discipline. You know, he'd have been a lot better pitcher and probably would last longer.
Exactly,
And that's the reason why I think that we had that great respect for one another. And I recall Doc had rollers in his hair. And, you know, as players, you know, it was no big deal to us. We just sat back and laughed. And I recall one time we were in Cincinnati, and then all of a sudden, you know, in Cincinnati, they gave you an ID card that you had to show the security guard in order to get into the clubhouse. And so Doc happened to have left his card back at the hotel.
Yeah.
And so the guy wouldn't let Doc in. So Doc said something to the security guard, and next thing that we knew, the guys that were at the clubhouse early, and I always got there early, the security guard had sprayed Doc with mace.
Oh, nice.
So I'm sitting in the clubhouse. He comes in with his eyes all bloodshot and everything. But I think what happened was Doc had said something back to him.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and then I remember 1971 in Baltimore, when we were playing the Orioles in the World Series.
Yeah.
You know, they put us up in the Lord Baltimore, and the beds were too small. And so Doc came back downstairs along with many other players. And the headlines were, at that time, Doc Ellis said the beds were too small. the same thing happened that same year in the playoffs when we were in San Francisco. But whatever Doc said, it made headlines. But
yeah.
You could not have met a guy with a bigger heart than Doc Ellis. I'm glad I saw that part of Doc. I felt honored that I had a chance to eulogize him in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his wish, which I didn't know at the time. But when I was told, I wasn't totally surprised neither, because he knew that I would say what needed to be said in the proper way.
Right. Well, may he rest in peace.
Yes.
Doc Ellis.
He was a character.
Yes, he was. Unfortunately, he's remembered for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It just unfortunately, they weren't teammates of his.
Exactly.
And it would have been different, but he was something to see. That's all I could say. The thing about Doc, he could pitch.
Yeah, he could.
And
yeah.
Doc was a good pitcher.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
But I enjoyed being around him.
Good man. Well,
absolutely.
We're speaking to the great Al Oliver tonight. Now, how did you feel going over to Texas after your great years in Pittsburgh?
Well, that was a tough day for me.
Yeah.
When I was traded, I knew I was going to be traded.
Mm-hmm.
It was no doubt in my mind that I was going to be traded. Why? I really don't know. But then again, I said, well, if I stay there in 1978, then I would become a full 10-5 player.
Right.
Which would have given me the upper hand or the power, as you might want to say, which there's no way in the world I wanted to leave Pittsburgh. Now, my first year and a half, yeah, because I wasn't playing every day. But once I was established as a player, had not even come into the prime of my career, had become a huge part of the community, and I've always been the type of person that I wanted to be involved in the community and stay there. You know, a lot of players might say, well, as long as you're making money. Well, money is fine, you know, but I would much rather have made less and stayed in Pittsburgh and be stable with the community to raise a family.
Right.
And so I never get that I was traded. Harding Peterson was the general manager, and they were over in Hawaii. And so finally the phone was ringing, and I knew what it was. And he had called me to tell me that I was being traded to Texas. And you know how they explain to you, you know, we hate to do this, but it's a move that we had to make, and we're going in a different direction. And I did not let him finish his speech. I just hung the phone up.
Right.
Because it wasn't anything else that he could have said that would have made me feel any better about leaving the Steel City.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing I thought about going to Texas, I really didn't know exactly where Arlington was. I knew it was near Dallas. And naturally, most of us know the tragedy that happened with our President JFK in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And that was really the only thing that was on my mind as far as going to Texas. I knew I'd be near there. But other than that, I didn't know a whole lot about Texas. But once I got to Texas, I really enjoyed it.
It didn't slow your bat down at all, Al, that's for sure.
Oh, no.
No.
Because I always had this mindset as a hitter. I took it from Little League. You know, the plate and the pitcher's mound is the same distance wherever you go
mm-hmm.
in the major league. And so it didn't matter whether it was the National or American League. And what's ironic, my first at bat and first game as a Ranger was the game of the week, and it was against Ron Guidry, of all people, in 1978. And so we all know what kind of year he had in 1978. He was almost unhittable.
Right. That was his year, yeah.
But to my advantage, when I look back, I got him early before he got started.
Okay.
So I singled off of him my first at-bat I singled, and that was my first hit and first plate appearance as a Texas Ranger and an American Laker.
And you went on to hit 324 that year.
It worked out well.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was really pleased with that year was my defense. Fans didn't know that I could play defense. You had to play some defense in order to be an outfielder, first of all. I mean, you had to be able to run. You had to at least at worst have an average arm. But I made some plays in that particular game where I threw out two runners, trying to stretch a single into a double.
Mm-hmm.
And I never will forget Billy Martin that said after the game, well, we heard that he couldn't throw. Well, somebody just had a bad scouting report.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but, you know, it was just one of those things that it just came into play, everything, defense, offense, and all of a sudden the fans took to me. And from then on, you know, I felt that I could catch everything that was hit to the outfield.
Yeah.
It's a great place to play, and it's a great place to live.
And sooner or later, who are you reunited with down in Texas?
Well,
your buddy.
Richie Ziff.
Right. And Doc.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doc, you know, Doc. And, of course, you know, I never forget Billy Hunter.
Yeah.
Was our manager. And we had a rule that you couldn't, he would prefer not to drink in a hotel bar.
Okay.
So, you know, I never was a drinker anyway, so it didn't faze me. And so Doc decided to get some players. He said, we're going to the bar. And we were going into Minnesota. I never will forget it. And so Doc went in there with some players. And then him and Billy Hunter, they got into an argument. And right after that, it seemed like things kind of went downhill for Doc. But Doc, once he made his mind up, he was going to do it. And nobody was going to tell Doc what not to do. Because he didn't see any problem, you know, with players in the hotel bar. I think Doc had mentioned the reason why they didn't want players in the hotel bar because a lot of the managers and coaches were in there drinking.
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't look good.
Yeah. Sounds like sort of a Billy Martin type rule. Yeah, or Casey Stengel.
Casey,
used to say, I don't want you drinking in the hotel bar because that's where I drink.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I look back at it, you know, if you're going to drink, probably the safest place would probably be in the hotel bar rather than going out in the streets at some of these nightclubs.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably the best place to keep yourself out of trouble.
Yeah, that's right. You probably get in less trouble.
We're running a little low on time, Al. Let's get to the book. You just wrote your book, Life's a Hit, Don't Strike Out. You did some signings at a couple of the ballparks. Tell us about the book.
The book was written because of my life. Things that I've gone through in my life, lose my parents when I was young, the consistent trade rumors and being traded for whatever the reason, which I still would never know. The fact of the matter is, regardless of what happened to me, I was always able to stay positive and have a good attitude about life. And I have talked to several people over the years, and they didn't know that I had gone through all these things in my life, and they asked me, how do you keep a positive attitude? Well, I just tell them it was my upbringing, the way I was raised. And in reading this book, I hope what comes out of this book is regardless of who you are, young or old, male or female, whatever struggles you have in life, if you have the faith in God that things will always turn out for the best, and the statement is always is true, through God, all things are possible. So when these young people are struggling in life, you know, I hope some of them read this book to see a young guy from Portsmouth, Ohio, a small town, be able to make it to the major leagues and be successful and to have gone through all the things I've gone through in life. I think that I hope that I am an example for a lot of people who read this book that are having problems and issues and that are struggling in life, because life is a hit. Don't strike out. We don't need to strike out. We need to get base hit.
Exactly. Excellent, Al. Well, let me just read this for the folks. Al Oliver, he batted 300 or more 11 times. His 2,743 career hits rank 45th on the all-time list. He also ranks among all-time players top 50 in games played. That's 2,368. Total bases, 4,083. Runs batted in, 1,326. And extra base hits, 825. He was among the league's top 10 in doubles 9 times and among the league's top 10 in hits 9 times as well. And he finished in the top 10 in batting average 9 times. 5 times he was among the league's top 10 in total bases, and 4 times he was in the top 10 in RBIs. Because of all the things he did, Al's name has been mentioned more than once as a possible inductee into the Baseball Hall of Fame. I know players such as Andre Dawson, who is in the Hall of Fame, has championed Al's name for the Hall of Fame. I'd really like to see his name mentioned again. And again, the book is called Life's a Hit, Don't Strike Out. Al, where can we get that book?
You can get the book through Amazon.
Amazon, okay.
Yes, you can get the book through Amazon. And I would suggest, especially to parents, all I can say to all parents, all young people need to be disciplined. Our children, we need to discipline. And I really believe that if we discipline our children in a manner in which we should, I think the less problems that we will have with our young people in this nation.
Excellent. Okay, well, Al Oliver, thank you for taking your time out on Sunday night. We know you're an early riser. Thanks for taking the time to talk baseball with us. It was a career worthy of enshrinement in Cooperstown. Thanks for being with us, Al.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Al Oliver, ladies and gentlemen. Well, next up, we'll talk to author Hal Bodley about his latest book, How Baseball Explains America. Stay with us, folks.
Radio New York and AM 1240 WDBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WDBB. Or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip change. Use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this World Series weekend. We got fall, we got October. The Fall Classic is in full swing. My next guest has covered baseball since 1958 and is currently senior correspondent for MLB.com. He is the former baseball editor of USA Today, and he served as broadcast analyst for CBS, CNN, and NBC. He is the co-author with Pete Rose of Countdown to Cobb, My Diary of the Record-Breaking 1985 Season, and author of The Team That Wouldn't Die, the world champion 1980 Phillies, that is. I welcome in tonight Hal Bodley. Hal, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How are you tonight?
Very good, sir. It's a pleasure having you aboard.
Always my pleasure.
Well, you certainly got some great accolades on the book jacket, Hal. I got to say, from Tom Brokaw, Bob Costas, Joe Torre, Tim McCarver, Dallas Green, who we've had on to discuss his book, and the foreword by George Will. I tell you, that's great. Now, what we know about the baseball, the hot dogs, the apple pie, the idea kind of was out there. Explain to us how you took the idea for the book, and without getting into the specifics, which we will, how were you going to develop this?
Well, you know, Bill, baseball is so important to our society and so essential, I think, to our way of life in this country. And it kind of ties in. It sort of weaves into our everyday life in somewhat of an obscure way, but it's very, very important. And I thought I could try to pull that off. And how baseball explains America, that's what I was working on. The fact that, you know, in the 1940s, for example, Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier for Major League Baseball, but it's far-reaching in our society. It moved down the line to other things as far as civil rights was concerned, that type of thing. I mean, I just think baseball is so important to our society, so essential, and I tried to pull it off in this book.
Definitely, and you did a great job. Now, you start out with the core unit in the country, the family. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, a lot of times it's the Bob Boones, the Ray Boones. It moves down the line, the children. I remember at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia watching these young guys on the field prior to a game. They were, you know, probably 6, 8, 10 years old. Turns out they were Aaron Boone and Brett Boone and also Tug McGraw's son was out there, too.
Yeah.
And now then they moved to the major leagues. Buddy Bell, his son's played in the major leagues, that type of thing. It just goes down the line. It's so important, I think, the family aspect of baseball and how it sort of like woven into the people that play the game.
Who knows who we'll see today that we'll see tomorrow.
That's right.
Exactly.
Very much so.
Yeah. Now, and then you move a little further, and we talk about a kid's game, which most of us have been involved in.
Well, I think you're probably talking about the Little League chapter in the book. You know, a young man was pitching for his father's team, and he wasn't a pitcher. He was brought in when no one else was available to pitch in this Little League game, and it got to be double digits, 10-0, 12-0, and so on. And he kept trying to find home plate and couldn't. The bases were loaded and the runs kept coming across the plate. And I like to make the line, the game wasn't as close as the score. But actually, when it was all over, his dad talked to him and talked about how important it was. And years later, I talked to this young man, and he said the lessons you learn by losing are sometimes more important than the lessons you learn for winning.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Manuel, the former Phillies manager, told me that, you know, to teach a youngster how to compete and how to lose, how to handle losing, is very, very important. And that was what this chapter was all about. But Little League is very important, I think, to young boys and girls. It's been a part of our way of life for a long time. and I wanted to talk about that and how it weaves into to what I was trying to say and how baseball explains America.
Exactly, yeah. How to lose. That's real, real, real tough, Al.
Boy. It's not easy, my friend.
No, yes. Now, one important chapter that I enjoyed, and I read it again today, was mirroring baseball's problem with performance-enhancing drugs with the country's war on drugs, with the drug problem in America.
Well, you know, Bill, back when Mark McGwire was trying to surpass Roger Maris's 1961 home run record, single-season home run record, we talked a lot about how important it was to baseball, and little did we know until Andro was discovered in his locker that these performance-enhancing drugs were going to play a very, very major role in the inflated statistics for home runs and other things in baseball. I talked about that in the book, how it we didn't really know too much about it, but then it exploded into a big, big story, a big part of Major League Baseball, and we dealt with it. Congress dealt with it. Commissioner Bud Selig dealt with it. And now what they have been able to accomplish is the best drug testing, the best program in all of professional sports. But it was a lot of growing pains on the way, and a lot of dark clouds hung over the game during that period.
Definitely. And it seems we still have doubts, Al.
We do, but I think that they're fewer and fewer. But as long as you have the scientific know-how, there's going to probably be somebody out there that's going to figure out a way to beat the testing and to do it. It's always been that way. Most anything we do in life, I mean, there's a way to sort of get around the law.
Somebody's always going to beat
but,
it. Yeah.
But I think the game is cleaner than it's ever been, and I think it's sad that during this period of time that when these records were being broken, when Hank Aaron's record was broken, and so on. That the performance-enhancing drugs had to be involved.
Yeah, we were so euphoric, weren't we?
I think so.
It was amazing, yeah. We're speaking to Hal Bodley about his book, How Baseball Explains America. And I also enjoyed your tie-in about how baseball's move to California really enhanced the game, as did the nation's push westward, changed the economic landscape and really the face of the country.
You know, it really did, Bill. The furthest west we went prior to 1958 was St. Louis, and most of that was on a train.
Right.
Teams traveled by train and went to St. Louis and so on. That was the furthest west. And then suddenly in 1958, the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles and the Giants moved to San Francisco, and we were suddenly an airborne sport. But not only that, we were a national sport then. I remember in 1958, climbing aboard a DC-6, a propeller-driven airplane, with the Philadelphia Phillies flying to San Francisco for the first trip that they would, make during this new era in baseball, and sat with Benny Bengal, the manager or the coach for the Phillies, who had been a roommate of Babe Ruth. So, it was really was a big moment in baseball when we moved west.
Definitely, yeah, and. Tremendous chapters talking about the chief executives of the country and the impact that they've had on the sport of baseball. And I especially enjoyed the descriptions of George W. Bush going to throw out the first pitch before the World Series in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks, and the stories of Bill Clinton. And speak a little bit about that, Hal.
Well, I was very fortunate working and writing and being an editor at USA Today to have access to the presidents, to be able to interview them as a journalist. I remember that 1997, when number 42, Jackie Robinson's number, was retired at Shea Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
I had planned for some time to have a one-on-one interview with President Clinton, and it came about that night, and we sat in a little room prior to the formal ceremony. And, Bill, I asked him one question. I said, presidents always call champions. They call people that exceed and excel and do different things in sports. I said, if you were to have called Jackie Robinson the day that he broke the color barrier in baseball, what would you have said? The president thought for a moment or two, and Billy said, it wouldn't have been about baseball. He said, I would have talked to him about what it meant to our society overall. To break the color barrier. and that type of thing. And I thought that was a really dynamite answer that he gave me. Another time I got a phone call from President George H.W. Bush and asked me to go to the All-Star Game in 1992 aboard Air Force One. And that was probably, you know, an event of a lifetime for me. And we sat and we talked about the players who had been chosen for that All-Star Game. We went up and down the rosters for the American League and the National League, and somebody couldn't understand why in the world this player was chosen and why in the world that player was chosen. And then he finally said, you know, my son just fired Bobby Valentine, his manager of the Texas Rangers, and we don't like that at all. We like Bobby Valentine. So, you know, it was a nice journey to be able to talk to the presidents and get their view. But they were very, very important in baseball, I think. Throwing out the first pitch, you know, after 9/11 when George W. Bush went to Yankee Stadium during the World Series and threw the ceremonial first pitch, it was a moment that brought goosebumps because our society and our country was in mourning at that time because of 9/11.
And he didn't bounce it.
No, he didn't. He rehearsed a little bit under the stage.
Yeah. That was great. Now, something we just lived through, Hal. We celebrated this summer the election to the Hall of the triumvirate of Bobby Cox, Tony La Russa, and Joe Torre.
You know, when that happened, I was sitting in Orlando at the winter meetings last December, and these three gentlemen were on the stage, having just been elected to the Hall of Fame. And it dawned on me that this was probably the end of an era of managers. And I thought about it a little bit, and I talked to several people about it, because these guys had managed, you know, a ton of games, many, many games, World Series, you know, so on and so on and so on. But I couldn't see anybody coming along that would manage the way they did, because they were the faces of their teams.
Mm-hmm.
And now a manager basically is an extension of the front office, extension of the general manager. Sabermetrics play such an important part in it. And so it probably was a time when these types of managers, the last of the breed, so to speak. I think Jimmy Leland should be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bruce Bochy, who's managing in the World Series as we speak, if he wins, there'll be three World Series victories out of five. He certainly should go to the Hall of Fame. But basically, I think the ilk of the Torres and the La Russas and the Bobby Coxes, that's kind of a thing of the past, the end of an era.
You're exactly right. There's nobody, no tenured manager that's been around for a long time. They come and go.
They really do.
There's nobody that sticks around. Perhaps Madden, if he had stuck around in Tampa Bay, would have been somebody like that. But you're right. There's nobody like that anymore.
Well, you know, I talked to Joe about this actually during the winter meetings in December, and he said you're probably positively right, because he talked about how managing is for him right now, or was for him with Tampa Bay before he left last week. Basically, he said that, you know, it starts with the general manager and everything feeds down to the manager. It's just kind of a quote unquote, maybe a cliche, but a team effort, so to speak, to manage the team. Now you get the sabermetrics guys putting in their 2 cents. You get the general manager helping with it, and so on and so on. No longer does the manager rule with an iron fist as they did in the past.
No. So you're right. That was a great chapter there, Hal. Great job on that. Now, another chapter I really enjoyed. What we do on the show here periodically, Hal, is something that I really enjoy, is something I call baseball at the movies. And I've had on people like D.B. Sweeney and Robert Wall and Max Gale, Megan Cavanaugh, and we talk about their roles in different movies, Bull Durham, League of Their Own, 42. And I enjoy reveling in the culture of the movies. I have yet to bring on a musical guest, but I'd enjoy that in the future. And you really delve into that in that particular chapter. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I love music and I love the movies, and obviously I have a great passion for baseball. I called Terry Cashman.
Right.
Terry Cashman wrote Talkin' Baseball. We all hum that and sing it. I mean, you know, the Mickey, the Duke, the Duke, the Duke, and so on. And I asked him, you know, the whole motive behind that. And I thought it was so exciting for what he told me, Bill. He said, you know, when I was a kid, we used to go down on the street corner. and we would wait for the newspapers, because at that time, of course, you didn't have the internet and you had very little television. To get the real news about baseball, you waited for the paper to come. And they would wait on the, in New York City, they would wait on the corner for the newspapers to come and the truck driver to throw them on the street and that type of thing. And he said, in the meantime, we're talking baseball. We're talking about Mickey. We're talking about the Duke. We're talking about this one. We're talking about the Giants. And we're talking about the Dodgers. And we're talking about the Yankees. And he said, it's talking baseball. And he said, that's how I got the idea for the song. He did it in 1981. And, of course, in 1981, baseball had a 50-day strike. Did not come back until the All-Star game in Cleveland that year. And so he wrote this song, and he said that that was really an uplifting moment for baseball, which had such a dark moment because of the strike that had silenced the game for much of the summer. So that was a really good part of it. And, you know, of course, he'd have, you know, take me out to the ball game, and we had these great movies that you just mentioned that we all love. And you know, I talked about basically how they came about and how the actors enjoyed playing the roles in those movies and that type of thing. So, as I say, when you talk about how baseball explains America, this is all part of it. It has to weave in.
And I enjoyed how you brought it. Well, really, James Earl Jones talks about none of the movies are about baseball.
That's right.
They're about
That's
people.
Right. They're about people. Hey, the game's about people.
Yeah.
The game on the field's about people. It's a great game, the greatest game ever invented. But don't forget, it's about the people that are playing the game on the field.
And it's just like other movies where we talk about leave the gun, take the cannolis. if you build it, they will come.
That is
know?
Right.
Or,
what a great movie that was.
Yeah.
Positively.
There is no crying in baseball or candlesticks make a nice gift.
Well, Bill Mazeroski says that's not true.
Yeah, exactly.
He stood up at the Hall of Fame, started the delivery speech of induction, and then he starts bawling like a baby. He lasted about 2 minutes. So there is crying in baseball.
Oh, poor Bill. Yeah. I enjoyed that one. Now, talking about Jackie, of course, Robinson, what is his legacy in America? Let's talk about that.
Well, I think his legacy has become more and more important as the years have gone by. In 1947, I mean, Branch Rickey had to choose somebody that was strong mentally, strong physically, and also a gifted athlete to be able to do what Jackie Robinson did. And I think it set the stage for an awful lot of really good things that happened in baseball that have happened in our country. It was a big moment. It was a huge moment in baseball and in our society when that happened. And I talked to Pee Wee Reese, and I talked to several of the players years ago that played with him that year, and how difficult it was, but how strong mentally he was to be able to do it. And I think such a great lesson was learned from that. I believe that when the number 42 was retired during the 50th anniversary, as I mentioned, in 1997, I think that was so important, because you go to any stadium, Bill, and you look on the outfield wall, and that number 42 is up there, and it's got to remind you of that big moment.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly immortal and deservedly so. Now, the one thing I enjoy in the Hall of Fame, Hal, I'm sure you've seen it, the wall that gives you all the cliches of baseball. Now, you talk about the lexicon and how it intertwines with the language in one chapter. And we talk about things such as, I'll touch base with you tomorrow. Right off the bat, this guy starts in with me. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Bill, that's a great one, I thought, because I probably forgot. I mean, I tried my best to come up with as many of them as I could in that particular part.
Have you seen that wall up in the hall?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have. But, you know, I was speaking to a group not too long ago, and I said, I have a question for everybody in this audience. Can you go one full day without using a baseball term in your language? I mean, can you? And nobody could say that they couldn't. I mean, it's positively all part of it. Everything we do. I mean, you know, you're gonna hit a home run. I mean, I got shut out.
I
didn't get the first base.
Yeah.
You know that. Hey, I struck out.
Yeah.
I just hit it out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
You know? it's all about baseball, and I think that's wonderful and so important to our society and so important to baseball.
You're way out in left field.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people are.
Yeah. Now, how are you enjoying the series, Sal?
Well, I am. I was at the first two games in Kansas City, and I decided not to go on to San Francisco and wanted to take it a little bit easy. But the first two games, I thought they were good. I feel like these teams are rather evenly matched. I felt like San Francisco would win because of the experience, although Kansas City has proven that the Royals are just as good. I mean, they've not in any way had any stage fright about being in the World Series for the first time in 29 years.
Not at all, no.
I think
no.
It's going to be a good World Series before it's over. It goes back, of course, to Kansas City for Game 6 after tonight, and I think we're going to have a great World Series to go down to the wire.
Nobody wants to go away, that's for sure.
No.
I'm really surprised that both of them got there in the first place, and Kansas City certainly was a buzzsaw cutting right through anybody who stood in their way.
Well, really, if you know, Bill, we've all talked about this an awful lot. The games have to be played. I mean, they don't play the games on paper. They play
right.
them on the field. And obviously, these two teams weren't the best teams in baseball this year.
No.
Washington and the Los Angeles Angels were probably the best teams, at least by record. But, you know, sometimes you don't want to convince a team that it can't do it, because Kansas City was determined to they played so well and they gelled and the chemistry was good, and the same thing with San Francisco. And at the moment, to be able to get where they were the hottest team in baseball, and they had the best momentum at the time, and everything was clicking for them. And I think that's what happens. It's not always the best teams on the field, but certainly the teams that deserve to be there at that moment.
Excellent. You're exactly right. Any current ventures you want to tell us about, Hal?
Not really. Just, continuing to love baseball and to see a lot of baseball and to have a great passion for it.
All right. Well, you get back to the TV set, Hal. It's been a pleasure having you back with us tonight. The book is called How Baseball Explains America. It's from our buddies out at Triumph, available on Amazon. And, again, thanks for being with us, Hal.
Bill, it's always my pleasure, and good luck.
Hal Bodley, folks. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about one local hero in the World Series. That's Joe Panik of the San Francisco Giants, second baseman. For those of you who don't know, he is from John Jay High School, which is upstate in Hopewell Junction, New York. He went to college at St. John's University. He played for the Red Storm in the Big East Conference. For those of you, again, who don't know, he compiled a .398 batting average, 19 doubles, 10 home runs, 57 RBIs during his junior season. That ranked 10th among college baseball players, .509 on-base percentage. He earned All-America honors from the America Baseball Coaches Association, Baseball America, and also Louisville Slugger. He was also a finalist for the Brooks Wallace Award. That's an honor given to the nation's top shortstop. He was also a first-team ABCA All-Northeast Region honoree, a first-team All-Big East selection, and he won the Red Storm Most Valuable Player Award. St. John's, Giants drafted Panik in the first round, 29th overall, of the 2011 Major League Draft. He made his professional debut with the Salem Keizer Volcanoes of the Class A Short Season Northwest League, where he led the league with a .341 batting average, 49 runs scored, 54 RBIs, and a .401 on-base percentage. That's for Salem Keizer. He won the league's MVP award. He was rated the 10th best second base prospect prior to the 2012 season, and he was invited to spring training with the Giants. He spent the 2012 season with the single-A San Jose Giants, batting .297 with 27 doubles, 7 home runs, and 76 RBIs in 130 games. In 2013, Joe was promoted to the double-A Richmond Flying Squirrels. You know them, Brian. Where he was moved to second base and recorded a .333 on-base percentage, 27 doubles, 4 triples, and 4 homers. And then in 2014, Joe started the season in AAA with the Fresno team, where he hit .321 with 5 home runs, 45 RBIs, and 50 runs scored in 74 games. Joe made his major league debut on June 21, 2014, pinch hitting for the pitcher in the 8th inning, drawing a walk against Arizona Diamondbacks relief pitcher Matt Stites in a game against the Giants. The Giants won 6-4. Panic's first major league start came the next day, June 22nd, when he batted 7th and played second base. In his second at-bat in that game, he registered his first major league hit. Panic hit his first major league home run on August 22, 2014, against Doug Fister of the Washington Nationals. It was a 3-run shot, one of Panic's 4 hits that night, which gave the Giants the lead in a game they eventually won 10-3. And as we know, on October 16, 2014, in the 2014 National League Championship Series, Joe Panic hit a 2-run home run in Game 5 to help the Giants to an eventual 6-3 victory over the St. Louis Cardinals to advance to the 2014 World Series against the Kansas City Royals. So that's a quick overrun or run over, however you want to run. On Joe Panic, whose career stats are 305, 2 home runs, 18 runs batted in. Joe Panic from Hopewell Junction, John Jay High School, upstate Hopewell Junction, St. John's University product. You should join us on the next show. My next show will be November 9th of 2014, where my guest will be former Jet quarterback Ray Lucas. He'll be talking about his latest book, and author Jack Cavanaugh will be talking about the cadets of Army, and that should be very interesting. So join us on November 9th, Ray Lucas and Jack Cavanaugh. So I think it's time to wrap it up. I'd like to thank you for joining me tonight. I'd like to thank my guests, Al Oliver and Hal Bodley. I'd like to thank Brian Graves, my engineer. And most of all, you, and you, and you, and you, and you, and everyone for joining us tonight. Stay tuned for hour 2 of Sports Talk 1240 with Eric Getzoff up next on Sports Talk 1240. As I said, I'll be back with you Sunday night, November 9th, with my guests, former Jet Ray Lucas and author Jack Cavanaugh. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.